I didn't say that.
Turn on this recorder. She's going now. Let's start this. Okay. If you could start just by stating your name, birth date, and age for the recording, just so we have it.
Okay, Lenore Ginsberg, and I was born February 2nd, 1944. And that makes me 66 years old.
Jim Monsonis, James more formally, July 1937, so that makes me...
27.
37.
Oh, you're 37, but you would do it. All right, go ahead.
Born in 1937, come on. Okay. Which makes me 70, whatever it is, 72 at the moment.
Great, and I guess I'll start with you, and where were you born?
I was born in Westerly, Rhode Island, which is right on the ocean, right on the coastline, right on the where Connecticut and Rhode Island meet, in the ocean, all meet. So that's where I was born and raised. Should I just proceed with what I was telling you before, was that I come from a Jewish family, and it was a Catholic town. And it was a rather racist in that sense of the town, so I think I was always very sensitive about being different and being viewed as different, and had some rather nasty anti-Semitic incidents in my childhood. So I think that probably was what resonated when I saw what was happening on the television and in my own community when I went away to college. That sort of drove me to stand up and do something about it.
And were you aware of more of racial issues too when you were at
Well,
that age?
The town is mostly white. There was a young black girl who entered our school in the sixth grade, and she was definitely shunned out. I was the only one who would talk to her. I went to her house. I used to play with her. She was extremely poor, and it was my first real vision of real poverty. But then she disappeared. I think the town was just too much for her family.
Mm-hmm. And what were your parents' background and politics?
My parents were uneducated. My father completed high school. Did not complete high school. My mother did complete high school. They came from immigrant families, and they were very poor. And so they had to go to work to support the younger children who were born after them. I think that they were probably more liberal than most people in the town, but they weren't political. And they were certainly not going to make waves, because you don't make waves when you're on the small group. And pretty much stuck with what little other Jews there were in the town. They were unhappy with what I did because of fear of danger to me, not, I think, because ultimately they disagreed with what I was doing. They were always on that sort of moderate liberal side.
And when did you first get involved with civil rights?
I graduated high school at 17 and went away to a very small college in Hartford, Connecticut, which has a large black community. And
Hartford, that's not the college?
Hartford.
Yeah.
And it was when I was looking at the images of the hoses on the young people that I really was mesmerized by what was going on. And so at that time, I tried to figure out what, I was too young really to leave, but I wanted to find out what could be done where we were. And there was something called the Northern Student Movement. And Peter, and I don't remember what his last name, not Countryman, Peter Morrell, he was a seminary student at Hartford Seminary. And I actually linked up with him and started tutorials, which is one of the things that NSM did around in the different schools in the community, for kids to come after school. It was mostly black kids, because we had them in the black community. And we organized college students from, there were about four or five colleges in the area, to volunteer for these tutorials. And so I set up these tutorial centers and got them staffed and worked on that. But we also got involved with NAACP, or I did, Peter didn't, NAACP in a boycott, selective patronage of Seal, what was the name?
Hood Milk Company, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Was it Hood or Seal? I thought there was something like, anyway.
Seal Test?
Seal Test. Is that a
yeah.
Yeah, okay, Seal Test. I thought I was crazy. And because they would deliver milk to the black community, but there were no black drivers. So I worked on organizing with, working with people from NAACP on organizing that. And we also had an office in, we set up an office in, SNCC support office in the black community. And so that was my attempt at, you know, trying to do something.
What are some dates for that?
That was in 60, I was trying to think, it was probably 62,
okay.
Right? And as a result of that, my picture was in some of the local papers, and I got kicked out of school for being active, so it's kind of crazy. So eventually, and this is where he can take over with his, I went down to New York City and linked up with the New York City office of SNCC, which is where I had a sister living in New York City. And I wasn't going to go back to school. I thought school was worthless at that point. I did go back later. And that's where I became active in that sort of Northern SNCC issue.
A comment that she does, I don't know if you even know this, the school denies that you were thrown out for that
stuff. I know they do.
I once inquired just independently, and they said you were dropped for failing classes.
That's right. And why did they fail me in my classes when I got A's on my finals?
That's their official explanation.
I don't care
has nothing
what it
to
is.
Do with this. Okay. Well, my history is, I'm about 7 years older than hers. My history comes from a different place, although I grew up in a small town in New England, in Connecticut also, although at the other end of the state. A mill town. The minority group in our town were French Canadians. There was one black family in town. Everybody knew them, everybody liked them, quote unquote. There was nothing of that issue at all. The school I went to had no black students in it, the high school, and my first even peripheral experience of black people was in my college entrance class. Of 1,000 or so. This is at Yale. In 1954, there were two or three black students in among the 1,000. And I got to know them just casually because we had seen classes together. But that was really probably the first time I ever talked to a black person directly. But I did get involved in that whole period of time with the student Christian movement. I've been active in my home church. I grew up as a Lutheran. There was an active group on campus. At that time, the student Christian movement in the United States was a multi-headed, quite active collection of organizations and groups. And eventually, I became involved at the national level with the Lutherans. After that, so I thought for a while I was going to go into the clergy. That was where I was headed. Took a year off after school for family reasons, and then went to Yale Divinity School. This would have been 1959 that I was at Yale Divinity School. And it was that spring of my first year when the sit-ins began. And Yale had attracted students from all over the country, of course. There was really quite a furious debate on campus about how to respond. And some of the students wanted to go down and picket Woolworths and all the rest of it. Actually, the Divinity School, more than the undergraduate, led the demonstrations at the local Woolworths, and I participated in some of those. I still have a memory of a little old lady whacking me over the head with an umbrella when I was on a picket line there. Right just before that, I should mention briefly that there was a major conference of the student Christian movement at the University of Ohio at Athens in December, just December, whatever, 59 it would have been, for a week-long thing, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 students for a week, and I was one of those. But the four kids who began the sit-ins were also there. An interesting kind of, I don't think I knew them there, but there were a lot of foreign students there, and there was a lot of discussion about Christians and revolution. The theme of it was Christianity and revolution, and a lot of anti-colonialism feelings, a lot of issues about race and so forth. So it was very much part of my consciousness, even though it was very abstract.
Where did that feeling sort of come from within that organization?
Well, I think it came out of the militant side of Protestantism, and from the fact that in many countries, the Christian students were very involved in revolutionary activities out of moral commitments. Many folks who later became leaders of the African and independence movements were at that conference, and we heard speeches by all of them. Jim Lawson was there, in fact, also was here. Richard Shawl was the main speaker, as a faculty member at Princeton Seminary, but involved in revolutionary movements in Brazil. So there was a lot of that sentiment. So part of my consciousness had already been shaped by this, even before this event happened. So that was 60 in the spring. Not at the Raleigh conference, but at the October conference, when SNCC took organizational form, in a real sense, rather than this temporary committee of the early period. The original committee was formed from representatives of the activist student movements in various states, plus a representative from the National Student Association, plus a representative from the National Student Christian Federation, which was this umbrella organization of the student Christian movements in the United States. That was in October, but in that August, before that, I had been elected to the national chair of the National Student Christian Federation. So I was the representative to the original SNCC. In fact, Tim Jenkins was the other, so I guess I was the first white guy in that technical sense, although at that time it was just a committee that just try to coordinate things. If you know that history, I really didn't do anything actively directly for a while. So that was my first involvement, and I still remember that October conference, coming here to Atlanta and walking into a room of 200-300 black students. That's the first time I'd ever seen that many black people in one spot together, and just a mind-blowing kind of experience for me. I went back to school. That first year I was working full time for the National Student Christian Federation, visiting colleges around the country, and talking about the sit-in movement and talking. I had a co-traveler, actually, the guy from the student Christian movement of Cuba, who happened to have a visa that was good in the United States, and the two of us traveled together talking about Christianity and revolution. We visited some 30, 40 campuses in the course of the year. Not here that I remember, but we entered a number of places. Randolph-Macon, I think we were at. That's about as close as we got to where we are here, which did not welcome us. That's another story I'll get into. I went back to seminary. The SNCC was meeting at that time about every couple of months as a weekend meeting kind of thing. And I'd go to these meetings, try to construct a budget for them, since I knew something about organizations, that kind of thing. Went back to seminary for one term and said that was it, I didn't want to, and dropped out and drove to Atlanta and moved into the office, more or less. They were all, the weekend I arrived, nobody really knew I was coming. they had all closed up. Foreman, Norma Collins, all those folks were off in the Albany and getting arrested. There was nobody, although the office was wide open, there wasn't a person there on Raymond Street. It was just completely empty, and the black newspapers across the street, so I went over there to find out what was going on and ended up spending a weekend somewhere out in the county and outside of Atlanta. First time I'd ever had a possum in my life, just gathering out of that woods. I knew many of the staff people from this monthly meetings kind of thing, and so I just moved into a role then from probably February of 62, this would have been now. I didn't have any particular assignments or whatever. I knew a little bit about organizations. There was a SNCC conference that spring of all the staff and all the local chapters, and I worked primarily putting that together, raising the money for it, writing a lot of foundations to support getting the money for that. That was at the Atlanta University complex. So I stayed there, essentially, in the SNCC office with Foreman and Julian, and those are the ones I remember, Norma Collins and one or two other people, and that was basically that until the summer. That was also concurrently the time that SDS was forming. I had been involved in SDS earlier from the student Christian movement side. Al Haber recruited me at that point.
Still SLID or?
SLID.
Well, yeah, when it was still SLID.
Right. Because they had a big chapter at Yale, right?
Yeah, but I wasn't part of that. I was out of Yale already, and this is when I was in New York working for the student Christian movement full time, mm-hmm. but I was involved with meeting the New York folks. And Hayden and Haber and the other folks, and was at the Port Huron meetings. So if you know where that one is, you know where that document was. That was my political education. Those are the guys who taught me in politics.
Right. Right.
I didn't know anything, really. I had a good Christian morality, but I had no politics other than saying, hey, you know, it'd be nice if we all lived together kind of thing.
Were there other people that bridged both of those worlds?
A few. Maria Varela. Tim Jenkins, both were at both of those meetings. Tom Hayden in a different way. Tom was primarily SDS, but he was also involved peripherally. Casey Hayden. I met Casey at the prior October at that big meeting in Atlanta. Dorothy Berlich, who's here,
right.
was also at that Atlanta meeting. I just saw Dorothy at lunch and tell her, this is such an experience for me to meet these white Southern kids out of Texas who really had a real sense of who they were and where they were going, because you really had to be at that point. So out of the SDS meeting at Port Huron, and really because it wasn't anything specific for me to do in SNCC except sweep the floors, although Foreman claims credit always for doing the guy who's sweeping the floors. I did a lot of floor sweeping too. So I stopped and I went to work for SDS for a year, and I ran the National Office of SDS in New York from that time through to the following summer. That would have been into the summer of 63, and went with an SDS group to the March on Washington. But I'd always been in touch with those guys. I was sharing an apartment in New York with Bill Mahoney, who was a guy out of the NAG movement in Washington, the Howard student, and very much involved in all this stuff. And in that fall, in September of 63, went back to work for SNCC in New York, in the office in New York, as a fundraising office, fundraising and education. We did a lot of speaking at schools, local schools. Not so much me. They didn't want to hear from a white northern kid. They wanted black kids to come out of the South. So I did a lot of arranging, setting up meetings, that kind of stuff.
And people would come up to...
Yeah, they'd come up. We'd have somebody up and saying they're going to come up for a week, and we'd arrange a whole bunch of things for them to speak. Parties, fundraising parties, things of this sort.
New York was good for R&R. You could get medical attention.
Oh, yeah.
You could go out and go to a bar or something.
Right,
you know, you could
right.
just sort of... Yeah, so then they would go around
speaking. Yeah. And I had an apartment just a couple blocks away from the office, which meant that most of these folks stayed with me. Not most, but many of them did.
Yeah.
As they passed through and a lot of good conversations there. And that was also part of my own political education. But again, it was an office run by, as far as pay goes, two of us, Julie Prettyman then, who's here. And you might find her version of this a little different and interesting, and a lot of volunteers. And I've had a lot of movement experiences, student experiences, and so forth, so that was why I was useful. And with a reasonable education, I could write a press release, that kind of thing. So I was in the New York office right down until the summer. Now, that's where our histories connect, because Lenore came in as a volunteer into that office.
I came in as a volunteer, and I started, then they actually put me on salary, but Foreman said he wanted me to go down to Washington because Mike Thelwell wanted to go to the summer of 64. He was running the office in Washington, and he wanted to go down to Mississippi, so they wanted... Foreman asked me if I would go down to Washington to work on that office and to set up an MFDP presence there. I remember, I'm very young and I'm very naive, not much sophistication, but I was good at that kind of thing. And then, so I went down to Washington, and then I think in a sort of romantic ploy.
Ivanhoe today said Foreman was such a romantic. That was his term. I don't know if you know of Jim Foreman,
yeah.
I imagine. romantic wouldn't be the first word that would come to my mind.
But he was, and I think that that's why he said to Jim, why don't you go down and also work in Washington office.
He knew we were
already
a couple.
Because we know we were a couple. And I seriously think that he was a romantic in that sense. He was a beautiful man, he really was. But anyway, so I went down to the Washington office, and Mike sort of left. And
I came a few weeks later.
Yeah, and you know, tried to set up some contacts with, I mean, one of the things they wanted for MFDP was contacts with Congress or in the Democratic Party to see if they could support people. So Frank Smith came later as well, and he's really the political one, and he
and Mike too.
And Mike, well, Mike was down in Mississippi.
Not yet. Mike was the one took me around to some of the congressional offices, introduced
right.
me to congressmen and to the staff. Often the Congress staff
yeah,
are more useful than the actual congressman.
Yeah.
You
definitely.
Need something run off, you could go to staff X and Y and Z.
Or access to
you know, or
that
act,
particular
you know,
congressman.
That kind of stuff.
You
yeah.
needed the staff.
Yeah. Right.
So. So we were in Washington, D.C. for the summer, went to Atlanta for the actual challenge, but mostly worked on the mechanics of getting the thing so that it would work, you know, so that raising money, getting community support, getting students, and just generally also when Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were murdered, but we didn't know that, you know, putting out the press releases, getting lots of people in Washington to Congress, FBI, whatever, to sort of move on this, not just sit on it.
One of the things we did that summer was to make sure that a congressman knew what students or young people from his district were working in Mississippi
yeah.
and where.
Right. So they could call.
So they could call and connect.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the congressmen were interested.
Right.
Some weren't. Didn't really want to know that, but we made sure they knew anyway. Len, what was his name? One of the son of one of the congressmen, Len Edwards.
Oh yeah.
Congressman Edwards from California. His son was involved in the summer project that year, and there were a number of others involved in that period of time. So we were cranking out press releases, making these contacts, letting parents know when they got called, and trying to raise some money. Belafonte, who spoke today, came down and gave us a couple of evenings, and we raised a lot of money with him.
Yeah, yeah.
$100 a plate dinner,
oh, wow.
you know,
wow.
that kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh, I think it was $1,000. That evening was
Well, one evening was
$1,000.
That was only a you know, handful of people to come just
yeah,
to meet with him.
Yeah.
Wow. That was only about 12 or 15 people, but, you know, they were willing to shell out
$1,000.
That's amazing, huh? Yeah. yeah. Especially then, it was
yeah.
a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. But
most of SNCC fundraising was like $5, $10 donations
yeah.
that would come in. You'd go out and you'd speak, pass the hat.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's, but $5 or $10 added up because you, your outgo wasn't that much. You,
mm-hmm.
Your salaries were pretty low,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you didn't have to count for, you know, didn't have to raise that much. But
we had contact in the president's office. Can't remember his name now. It'll come to me.
Okay.
So that when something happened in the South and they wanted to get to the White House, somebody could come up, and we could call, and they would make an interview to go over and meet Johnson. We stopped doing this after a while because Lyndon Johnson was so persuasive that these folks out of rural Mississippi or Alabama came away feeling that this guy was absolutely committed to their cause and would do absolutely everything. So we stopped doing that. We really discouraged it after a while because we could see, I mean, the payoff was the wrong thing. It wasn't making the point.
It's supposed to be the other way around,
yeah.
The persuasion.
Yeah, but somebody we could call anyway in the office there and let them know. And we did a lot of press work. Mostly what happened then is after they'd come up, we'd make sure they'd sit with Stephen Roberts of the New York Times. We had at the Times office in Washington or one of the other newspapers of the Washington Post people. The Post never had a single person working on civil rights. They had a whole bunch of them. But the Times had one person who dealt with that always. So a lot of it was that kind of stuff. It wasn't dangerous. I'd been traveling, actually, I haven't known others, took me through the South some before, mostly just to make sure I knew what I was talking about. I keep saying, you know, I don't have a lot of this history that a lot of the folks do. We really were rarely in a situation of some danger. I've been on odd picket lines here and there.
But there were some gems that came up. I'm thinking about the time that I sued the Washington Post for discriminatory advertising.
Hmm.
They had an advertise. I was looking for a house for Frank Smith, a place to stay, and it said White House, so I called him. What's a White House? And the guy told me, and we got an injunction against the guy, and we got an injunction against the newspaper, the Washington Post, and they agreed, and the agreement in the suit was that they would cease and desist in segregated announcements. So that was kind of fun. We integrated the house we lived in.
Yeah.
Just
and
we
got married
building.
In the middle of that summer.
So,
odd thing that it just happened.
But it was an interesting time, and it was an interesting place to be. It was definitely a southern city, very definitely. You know, we were in the black community.
We weren't paid very much, but then again, we got mostly free services because that was the nice thing about the support system that developed. Is that we needed dental work, we got it.
Yeah.
We needed medical work, we got it without any issue.
That was sympathetic.
Free.
For that's
sympathetic
right, exactly.
Support.
When
yeah.
I needed glasses, I could get another
yeah,
pair of
yeah,
glasses
nobody
and
would,
stuff like that.
Yeah, they certainly wouldn't. Somebody gave us a whole set of dishes for our wedding.
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't charge us for it, that kind of thing. It was a lot of that kind of nice support. You know, and that's important too, because that let people feel they were part of it, even if they weren't doing anything more than writing a check. They were also involved in some other sense. So we saw a lot of people just passing through, basically, on an office there, and handling a lot of that press kind of stuff and raising money. And that carries us to Atlantic City, and then things changed after that. The temper of the movement changed in many ways.
Right. But we didn't leave.
Periodically, there would be staff meetings in Atlanta or somewhere else, and we would go to those. But there was always within SNCC, too, the kind of sometimes explicit, mostly implicit division between the field people and the office people,
right.
You know, which was touchy sometimes. We were getting paid more, but we were paying rent,
and
we had to eat in
yeah.
a different way.
What were those disagreements about or tensions? Or
well, sometimes they were about money.
Money.
We were getting more.
I didn't ever sense it was about money.
No, you didn't?
No.
I think some of it was about program, feeling that they were the ones who should decide what programs, where we should, what we should do, where we should do. And we were white people, you know. We, by and large, kept a very low presence. We understood that. Zellner may have been an active egalitarian in terms of things, but I always understood that our job is to be there and shut
support.
Up and listen.
That's right.
And
just
not
support
to be.
What they're doing.
I don't think I ever said a single thing in any plenary session of any SNCC meeting, any time the whole staff gathered. Not that I can remember, although we were at them all.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I ever said a word in any of that. For a while, Foreman kind of appointed me out of this informal role of my job of being to integrate new white folks into the staff who were saying, weren't careful in language or whatever, and asked me to go take so-and-so over in a corner and have dinner with them and talked about how you deal with being around black people.
What would you tell them?
Mostly to shut up and listen, and not to flaunt your education.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big part of it, because we took for granted a vocabulary and a methodology of speaking that only the white folks from the North,
no.
or the black folks from the North,
That's
the
right.
people who came out of Howard or something like that, could deal. Stokely had a marvelous, he had total command of language. But somebody coming out of rural Mississippi wouldn't understand Stokely even.
Mm-hmm.
But there, we're even the other side. Not only do we have that on, but we're also the wrong color. So we kept a very low profile as far as that goes. We were among the very few married staff too at that period, although I don't think that was a particular issue.
No, but there definitely was a division between office and field staff. And then toward the late, after the challenge in Atlantic City, it was a growing discomfort of white and black. And I'm not sure, because at one of the meetings, Stokely came out with that awful statement of his, but...
That's wave one, yeah.
I have a sense that there was also an educational issue, because he was protesting that he wasn't like the others, that he was just, that he's black, and that makes him just like the poor, uneducated Southerner, and he really wasn't. So there was, class was beginning to play a role, I think, in some of the divisions. There was tensions. You can't maintain that kind of intensity for a very long time. And the office versus the other staff, and then white and black.
And race, and sex.
And sex, women were... He didn't take me around to show me to the different, Mike didn't, to the different congressional offices and introduce me. That was something
that was my
Jim
job.
Was going to do. So it was a lot of sex.
And he didn't take you
around.
Through the Delta. Ivanhoe
right.
wouldn't have taken
well,
me.
Well, Ivanhoe was too scared. He admitted.
Yeah.
Ivanhoe says, oh,
that was
I ain't
just
taking
simple intelligence.
I was
not
going to
ride
down.
Around
he
with,
said,
a, with a white woman.
And I understood that. I understood that 100%. I was not upset with Ivanhoe for that. But
once we got into this northern role, we were really we went south occasionally to some. I was in Albany briefly. You were in a couple of the places, but most of the time we were in the north or in Washington, and not very much involved in the day-to-day stuff that the movement got involved in. And we raised a lot of money in the fall after the Atlanta Challenge. We, because the clothing became an issue that winter, we put a whole boxcar of clothing from Washington area to Mississippi. I remember that. That was a big deal. And we got a local toy supply company to give us about a half a boxcar of toys for the kids. I don't know whatever happened to those. It could be something that maybe some kid had a little game, and that was, I thought, a nice thing to do. What happens from then? I guess the basic...
About the spring.
Yeah.
When tensions were heightened, especially around issues of class and white.
This would be spring
65,
because
yeah.
it was
65.
Summer 65.
Right.
We, I left first, and then Jim left SNCC. I left the staff, and then Jim left. But how did Tom get in touch with us?
Well, we could see the handwriting on the wall. It was clear that we were on, and we should be. the
yeah,
way
we,
the movement is going, we
with
knew that
the Black Power.
Yeah, Washington 100%. D.C. is not a place to have a staff office of two white people.
That's right.
In that doesn't make any sense.
And Black Power was very important.
Yeah, and it was becoming of and forming.
We always played that sort of low role that, and I, you know, I thought that that was the important thing to do, and maybe no role was the best thing to do.
So we had to do two jobs. One is to plan our successor for us, and the other was to figure out what we were going to do with our lives. I'll deal with those separately. Foreman gave us the names of three or four different people to take over the Washington office. And it was our collective, although I think with some misgivings, that we chose, we thought that Mary Berry would be the best successor for us. Not because we particularly liked Marion. I would say that no to his face, that we were never friends, and I never much cared for him as a human being. But he was smart, and he was very political, obviously. Look what happened in Washington. You know, he knew how to do the political game. And we thought he would be the best choice of the ones given to us. And so in late spring, must have been, Marion came over and took over the operation in Washington.
Which was the right thing.
Step back, because this is something of some note. In that spring was the first big demonstration, Easter time,
yes, right,
against the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
That was organized by SDS. Now, I still had a history and a relationship with all these SDS people, and it happened that one of the people from SDS called us and said, do you know where we could have office space in Washington? And we happened to have space in the building that we were in, and she said, yeah, come and use our space. And we've seen this, I've seen this in writing, saying that's just the great merging of SNCC and SDS, yeah, and all the rest of this, and it's symbolized by the fact that this, right, this demonstration was run out of the SNCC office. It didn't. There was no ideological dimension. It just happened to be who knew who.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were. And Bob Moses spoke at that rally, but we had nothing. Our office had no planning of it. It was planned entirely by SDS, and we just happened to have a convenient space for them to run it out of. But I went on that picket line around the White House for one afternoon. I remember Casey cussing me out because I had a white shirt and tie on, and she said, this demonstration is against people with ties. I don't know if she'll admit that, but I remember it very clearly.
Yeah.
I just come from some congressional office. I had a tie on. So anyway, the way it came is from, what was her first name, Bowman, another SNCC person. Another white one, in fact, knowing us and knowing we were kind of looking around to see what was going to happen next, called us and said, well, there's this guy up in New York who's organizing a statewide Head Start program in Mississippi, and he needs some help. Why don't you go and meet with him? And she arranged it. Something Bowman, I have a blank on her first name.
Okay.
Anyway, it might come.
So we went up to talk to Tom.
So we went up and met in a restaurant. We met at
Tad's Steakhouse, that junky steakhouse.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, on 42nd Street.
That's not my memory.
All right, anyway,
mine
we
is
met
that
with
we
Tom.
Met with the, at the White Horse. Where the,
no,
set.
And we,
anyway,
and he talked to us about CDGM. Do you know what that was?
This is the group called the Child Development Group of Mississippi,
right,
which
it
became the statewide
program.
Head Start program, mm-hmm, in Mississippi. Because what he needed, and why he was interested in talking to movement people, is that he'd been involved in the Medical Committee for Human Rights, and he designed a beautiful program. The Head Start program, highly imaginative, creative,
yeah,
program.
Very creative.
But he didn't have any contacts in the state. And we knew the movement people, and SNCC was at that time financially in trouble, and these guys needed a job. What they needed was a paycheck. They didn't need a job. They needed a paycheck. And we knew who they were, a number of them, and we thought we could make the connection for him. And he also was smart enough to know that he needed not only himself, but he needed entree into the black communities in the state.
And he was comfortable with it.
Yeah.
He was comfortable with that connection between SNCC COFO workers and CDGM.
Yeah, it was not an issue.
Yeah, Eastland blew his gaskets about it, but that was all
so
right.
Raleigh still has horses, huh? Two cops riding around horses,
yeah,
over there.
Anyway, so
anyway,
we went down to Mississippi for the summer of 65, And it what's fascinating to me is that the history has sort of made that a continuation of the SNCC civil rights movement.
Yeah, the connection between the Head Start and
Yeah.
We just had an interview with someone who presented that as Bob Moses' baby.
No, Bob had nothing to do with it.
Freedom Schools in the summer of 64, absolutely yes.
He said Head Start as well.
No.
Okay.
No, that was Tom Levin.
This came from, the federal government wanted a model program.
Oh,
they wanted something political.
War and poverty.
Right.
Okay, and this looked beautiful to them. And Tom had a number of very interesting dimensions to it. Not only were they going to run schools for kids to get them in the Head Start stuff, do medical care for the kids. I'll work with the parents to talk about how come you're not on the school board if your kids are all in the school system.
He wouldn't open up a center unless the community had gotten together and organized to have a center come there. So he essentially, it was an organizing tool. It was an idea around which the community could organize, and they had to help provide space and equipment for the schools. Not all the equipment, but you know, to participate fully in the formation of it. The teachers came from the community, and one of the things that he felt strongly, and I agree with him, is that this was a way for the children to see their parents taking control and to have some sort of dignified work and position in their lives, as opposed to the sort of, you know, shuffling aside that happens in the usual racist Mississippi.
Against a lot of opposition, he was committed to the idea that the teachers in these schools did not have to have professional credentials.
Right.
We're not going to be the black middle class handful of black teachers around. And there was a real effort made to integrate the schools, although we got almost no white kids, a handful, and they dropped out very quickly. So it became a black program right from the beginning, although not intentionally.
The food was bought from black farmers.
Hmm.
So, you know, $1.5 million a month was just poured into the black community.
About $1 million a month.
And one of the things that really riled Washington was that though the vans and everything that were being provided by CDGM were also being used for voter registration and for political work, which, you know,
violated the federal, theoretically the federal rules on all of this. But we ran it, and Lenore took over the money, ran the financial side of the whole operation, signing all the checks with an old check signature machine, and all those things.
Yeah.
The feds insisted on handing us an accounting firm from New Jersey that was going to handle all the thing, and all they did was just complicate the mess, and it took weeks. In fact, these guys are so incompetent that the local folks actually had a sit-in in the movement office to try to get their paychecks because these guys in New Jersey were so incompetent.
I just paid no attention to them, which also got me in trouble.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, but the federal inspectors would come down and say to her, "Are you too? I want to meet with you."
Yeah,
and she would say, "No,
I'm too busy.
I'm having time.
Go away. Leave your phone."
And because I had the contact with the movement staff, I basically headed up the staff side of it. We had about 800 staff people together in that Head Start, and we had about 6,000 kids, something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's in that range.
Mm-hmm.
80 something centers, 6,000 kids, which was more than the census said there were in that age group in the state of Mississippi.
Hmm.
That's how accurate the census was.
In the black community.
In the black community. We had more kids in the centers than the census said there were in the state. They just didn't care about rural blacks, and they never made it into the census. So we, and you know some of that history. We were at Mount Beulah, the old black college that was in the center of the state, on the administrative side. So other than some fleeting visits to centers, we really didn't get out and do the freedom schools or
the teaching side of it at all.
Our job was an administrative job.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we could do.
Yeah.
This is where our skills were. We got shot at once, but that's just in passing.
Well,
you got threatened by a shotgun once or twice up in
Holly Springs,
didn't you? Yeah.
Wow. How did that happen?
Oh, Fluky and I went to get an ice cream, and
it's a black guy.
It's a black guy, and the guy says, I said, I want an ice cream. He says, we don't have any. And I said, big mouth, I'm going to report you to the feds, you know. You have ice cream, I want some ice cream. And he says, you want some ice cream? He pulls out a shotgun. And I don't know how, but Fluky got me on the other side of this fence somehow, and the guy shot us, but that was it. It was intense, but you don't insist on your rights in certain circumstances. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
Well, think about shootings too. They happen so quickly. They either you're fine or you aren't.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly.
No,
what
and
happened,
the campus. This was an old defunct black campus, and a guy came on the campus and shot at the administration building a couple of times. You know, that kind of thing.
But it was
nobody got hurt.
It was an intense moment, an intense summer, kind of because it's a.
Oh, sorry about that. It's
a phone. Oh, it's a phone. Okay. And we didn't, again, we don't last very long. In the end of the summer, it was clear that our days were numbered. The OEO was bowing to pressure from the politicals and started pulling the teeth out of the program. They wanted licensed teachers. They wanted they were upset by the
they didn't want us to employ some of the doctors that we were using because they were quote unquote radical communists. That was one of the things
they wanted us to move to a campus that we would be more controllable.
They wanted to drop Tom from the running
Tom
of the
off,
whole thing.
You know, because
and they put a lot of pressure on the board, the state board of CDTM, and eventually the board asked Tom to step aside. Tom Levin, who ran the whole thing, and Tom did reluctantly, but he agreed. And
rather than destroy the whole thing,
and turned it over to me. My memory is it was a Saturday morning.
By Saturday night.
We thought about it for the morning and the afternoon and said, this is an untenable position. I can't do this. I'm just bowing to their wishes. Let them do what they want to do if they want to bring somebody else in from outside, but I'm not going to play this stoogey role. And I think we had dinner with them in Jackson and took a plane out that night, and I didn't come back to Mississippi for another 30 years or something like that.
40 years. 40
Maybe 40-something years.
Wow.
That before we returned to the state.
So how did those programs survive that kind of the pressure from?
Well, it was interesting. I was today being interviewed by a young woman who's doing her dissertation on CDGM.
Oh, great.
And so I learned enormous amounts from her, let me tell you. They did survive, but they were definitely changed. The natures of them were changed. They became more traditional Head Start schools. Parents became less involved in it. They, as I said, they required that teachers be registered, so they fired some of the community people who were working on it. It took years for, you know, like 3 or 4 years for this to all take place, but they moved it from this independent black identified place to another place. Apparently, they set up other Head Start programs, and they convinced, or at least this is the story that Aaron Henry says, they convinced him that he was on our board, and that that CDGM was not going to be funded, and so he went over to create this MAP, Mississippi, I guess, Action Project or something. And in fact, that wasn't true. And so there became this competition between CDGM and MAP, really nasty stuff. And really, I think, took what was a really interesting community-based Head Start program, just turn it into an ordinary, everyday. Mm-hmm. That's still good. Kids got food.
Yeah, right.
You know, they learned what colors are, and they learned what. But it didn't have that spark that it had before.
Because it really had a more radical purpose behind it. Tom comes out of the socialist movements of his youth. He was older than us. He would be what, 85 or so now.
Yeah.
Comes out of that background, and he really saw it as an organizing tool to organize with parents. and very much continuation of the kind of thing that SNCC would do with money.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Federal money, that's the problem. And somebody said today, you don't do anything, the federal government never pays for its own organ, the people who are going to organize
it's
to destroy
them.
It.
Right, right. And we knew that when we went down.
Yeah.
Federal money, you know, our days were numbered. If we're going to do anything, we're just going to be able to do it a short period of time. But boy, that was a fun three months down there.
So what did you both do next?
You went to graduate school.
Okay.
That was always in the back pocket in case,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Right.
And I went to work. I worked in the anti-war movement. I worked for an organization that organized GIs to
mm-hmm.
resist the war.
Mm-hmm.
And defended them when they went AWOL, found sanctuary for them, et cetera, et cetera. And also, I don't know if you know this part of the history, but there were newspapers that the GIs could produce themselves, and it was, you know, anti-war GI newspapers and coffee houses, and we funded those, and, you know, I worked with the Southeast Asia group. So I did that, until I finally later on went back to school because my interrupted college education was beginning to worry me, and I figured I was ready to go back to school. Pretty much after the signing of the peace agreement with Vietnam, the anti-war movement just dried right out.
At that time, for me, Danforth Foundation, which is now almost entirely committed to doing things in St. Louis only, at that time had a national program. And one of their programs was to fund the training of college teachers who were involved in social justice issues, which fit exactly my background. So I was able to get a Danforth Fellowship. A lot of the people on the committees are people I had been in seminary with before, years ago, so I knew them all. the review committees and so forth. So that's how I got funded for my graduate study. That program doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more funding of that kind of thing in the 60s than there is now. But that's basically our story.
One more little fill-up. I went back to school.
Oh, yes.
I went to graduate school. And I'm in public health, which is kind of not the same thing, but kind of the same thing. And right now I teach in the School of Public Health. I teach statistics to budding epidemiologists. But I did research for many years and into environmental health issues. So I kinda, it's not like going into corporate America or anything. I really felt like I was still doing something that was socially relevant.
Yeah. What sort of lessons or experiences did you carry into these other, into this later part of your life, specifically from the SNCC experience?
The SNCC experience?
Is there anything that you can think of?
Well, I think this is my political education,
mm-hmm.
But in the very broadest sense, the sense has been talked about a lot here. It's not accidental that later on in my college career, I taught courses on gender,
mm-hmm.
taught courses on maleness, for instance, at a time when anybody was only teaching about female side of it, they weren't teaching that there were two genders.
Mm-hmm.
I continued to teach about civil rights stuff. I taught about Asian studies. I taught about a lot of courses on immigration and that whole kind of thing, and on poverty. And it's not accidental that's a continuation of the kind of thing that was there. Now, for a long time, because of the way SNCC broke up, we didn't see any of these movement people for years,
mm-hmm.
except a very few handful of them, mostly the whites. Because of the way it's split up, they're just a handful of blacks, and it's only been in the last 15 years, really, that we've gotten to reconnect with any of the black people that we were once very close to. And those are mostly academics.
I think what I carried with me was a strong sense of, if you think something's wrong, stand up for it, or up to it. I teach him, even though I teach statistics and it's mathematical, I always interject, you know, why aren't you angry about public policy? Why aren't you angry about the health care? Why aren't you out there doing something about this? And talking about public health in Haiti, talking about public health after Katrina in New Orleans, and just always getting the students to sort of get out of their stupor and somehow think about things, you know, just don't accept them, just think about them. I don't think I get through to very many of them, but that sense of outrage that I had when I was a young, I think I still have that sense of outrage. I just wish I was younger and could do more, but I think that that's true.
I taught an unusual college most of my life, but those kids that I taught went off and did all kinds of activist stuff.
Yeah.
The core of Move On are old former students of mine, among other things. This is
Simon's
a little place
Rock.
Called Simon's Rock
okay.
College up
okay.
in Western Massachusetts that you've probably never heard of before.
Yeah, the guy who heads Move On is from Simon's
among
Rock.
Others. Some of them were scattered throughout Latin America, a whole bunch of places.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned New Orleans, but the two major
mm-hmm.
health centers
That's
there
right.
in New Orleans are staffed by former students of mine.
Wow. Set up by former students.
Yeah, set up and staffed by. So, in a way, that's another continuation of the same sense and the same.
In fact, they even have, when he retired,
the alumni.
The alumni put together a grant fund for, and they named it after him, and it's for students who want to spend a summer doing something socially relevant, and they can get a grant from the Jim Manzones Fund, which is pretty neat.
Which is very nice. I like that.
Yes.
They've done a lot. They've made some good films about poverty in America and in other places, Eastern Europe. One of my grantees is now working on resuscitating the Huron Indian language. He's Indian himself, working on keeping the language from dying. So we think there is a kind of spread effect from this stuff from our years.
Which is nice.
Does that cover it? I don't know.
I think
that's
perfect.
Correct.
And actually,
how does
like
that work out for you?
About, just only about 5 minutes left on the tape. So.
Well,
we
can stop it. 5 minutes.
Just stop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks
thank
a lot.
You. Thank you.
So we just have a little.
Do we have to sign a release or something like that?
Yeah. IRB
system,
release.
Course.
Yes. I know all about IRBs.
So there's actually two forms here. One is the interviewee life history form that has a little information about background. So that,
well, thank you for doing this. I think this is a lot of records to do.
Thanks for giving us your time.